Series, It Could Have Started Like This. Written by Dead Cake. Rating, teen and up. Fandom, Stargate Atlantis. Relationship, Rodney McKay, John Shepard. Series summary. A mix-up get-together per episode. Each fic is written as a missing scene and completely independent of the others. Recorded for 2024 Romancing Mix-Up. Adrenaline Junkie, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 1, Part 1, Rising, read by Library Chick 94. There are people everywhere, but John can't focus on them. He can only see the star chart spinning above him and listen as Dr. McKay asks him question after question, the answers sparking across the display as soon as John thinks of them. At some point, people leave. They must, because when John finally looks around, there's no one left but McKay, tapping away at a nearby computer. The chair tips up, lights dropping away, and John sways forward in a fit of vertigo. I think he manages to get out, but stops himself because he might be sick if he does anything besides sit. "What are you doing?" McKay snaps. He's suddenly back at John's side, his hand pushing back on John's shoulder, forcing him upright. "You're not going to be sick, are you?" It's like being high, or maybe just good old-fashioned drunk, or it's like he's been flying for hours, pulling off maneuvers he only dares to dream about most of the time. The dizziness is suddenly nothing compared to the giddy feeling bubbling up in his chest. It's so fast and absolute that he has to grab at McKay's arm to make sure he doesn't just float away. "Ow!" McKay whines, but he doesn't pull back. "Let me see if I can get Beckett back here to check you out." "I'm fine," John says, but his voice doesn't sound right, too low and rough. He looks up and finds himself caught by McKay's sharp gaze, and he can't keep himself from smiling. McKay makes a soft, distressed noise. "You've got to be kidding me," he says, pushing John to lean back into the chair again. This time the chair stays upright and the world is still. John wants to ask what the problem is, but his thoughts are derailed when McKay grabs at his wrist with one hand and places the other on his forehead. His hands are warm and firm, and they're setting sparks running across John's skin. All he can do is grin up at McKay and hope he feels it too. "Another adrenaline junkie," McKay says after a moment, squeezing John's wrist gently before dropping it. His hand slips from John's forehead as well, and that's just not... "McKay," John says, his voice more solid than before. He reaches out, snags McKay's wrist before he can turn around. There's a glare on McKay's face, but he almost looks amused. Maybe. "What is it, Major? Want to take it for another spin?" "No one's ever made me see stars before," John says. He can't stop smiling. He doesn't know if he'll ever be able to. The only thing he can think to do is pull McKay down and down into a kiss. It spirals lazily, the two of them breathing into each other, and John loses time again, but he doesn't care. All that matters is McKay's mouth and his wrist and the way his free hand is twisting into John's hair. "You know," McKay says a few moments later, his breath warm on John's lips, "no one's ever made me see stars before either."
Better and Better, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 2, Rising Part 2, read by Lydia Gestrell. Sitting in the pilot seat, the one on the left, he knows without thinking, John breathes through his pre-flight mantra. It's harder this time. His mind skips and stutters each time something flashes to life on the console in front of him, each new control lighting up the way the whole ship had when he'd first stepped inside. He's never felt quite like this before, like he's lit up inside as well, like there's something vital and alive thrumming under his skin. It takes all of his self-control not to run his hands over every available surface just to see what will happen. McKay stumbles up behind him, grabbing at the back of the chair. It tips back slightly, but John barely notices. Any luck? Feeling out the controls at his fingertips, John ignores the heat of McKay's breath on his neck. He puts aside the fluttery feeling in his stomach when he thinks about what he's about to do. He needs to focus, to learn this new ship as quickly as possible. Except, it's easier than all that. The ship comes alive as he grips the stick, lifting off the ground almost as he thinks that it would be cool if they got some altitude. He turns them in a slow arc, then moves them in a small circle around the bay. It's so smooth that it's almost like the ship is reading his mind. Distantly, he realizes that McKay is still over his shoulder, pulling back on his chair. "This is amazing," McKay breathes, and he's so close, it's almost intimate. John twists around to look at him, his breath catching at the power of the smile on McKay's face. And maybe he's grinning just like that, too, big and goofy and uncontrollable. "You have no idea," he says, hands tight on the controls as he sets the ship back down. It's hard to believe that 10 minutes ago, everything had been spinning out of control, spinning out there in space with a mouth that they're never going to be able to retrieve, their people captive without even the option of rescue. Now he can set things right. He can get everyone back, and it's all because McKay has handed him a real-life spaceship. There's silence for a moment, just the two of them breathing and the ship settling back in its dock. "Thank you," John finds himself saying, without really meaning to. "This is exactly what I need." McKay starts, the words stilted and strangled, and John finds himself being spun around. McKay's eyes are wild, wide and shining in a low light of the ship, and his face is twisted up almost like he's angry. But his eyes drop down to John's mouth, and John knows, just like he knew with the ship. He tips his chin up, just a little, just enough to say, "Yes, do it." And McKay's right there, kissing him. His thumbs arc up against John's face, and John melts into it, pulling McKay down into the chair and on top of him. McKay pulls back slightly, his teeth catching on John's lip. "Elizabeth," he says with conviction. John has no idea what he means, and he doesn't care to find out, just chases after the kiss. Frustratingly, McKay puts a hand on his chest to stop him. He says, "I have to go get Elizabeth." "I can," John starts, but McKay pushes back on his chest and shakes his head. He waves at the console behind John, already turning to leave. "Figure out what that does." John spends the next 5 minutes imagining what it would be like if he and McKay were completely alone. No interruptions, no visitors, everyone else safe, until he realizes that the ship is cloaked around him. Things are getting better and better.
Fight, flight, or freeze? A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 3, Hide and Seek. As read by Ishtar. Rodney is frozen where he stands. He can't move a muscle when he tries. Nothing more than a wild jerk of his head to see that, yes, Shepard still has the gun aimed at his leg, and yes, Shepard is still staring, his mouth hanging slightly open. "You shot me," Rodney says, focusing back on the spot on his leg that should be bleeding profusely at this point. It's not. It looks perfectly normal, maybe a bit wrinkly in the pant leg. "Technically, I didn't," Shepard says, breathless. And when Rodney glances up, Shepard is staring at that spot on his leg that should be a mess. Without really thinking, without even meaning to, Rodney says again, "I can't believe you shot me." It sets something off in Shepard, though, because he's suddenly a flurry of movement, checking the safety on his gun and shoving it back into its holster. "You asked me to," he snaps, his tone more panicked than annoyed. Still unable to move, and how does he always forget that it's fight, flight, or freeze? Rodney throws all of the adrenaline pumping through him into his voice. "I didn't think you'd do it." "Yeah, but..." Shepard starts, swallowing audibly. When Rodney manages to look up into Shepard's face again, he finds him grinning. "It worked." And he's right. It worked. The shield deflected the bullet, and Rodney is 100% completely fine. "That was awesome," Rodney breathes, finally able to twist his leg around, see it from all angles. Shepard laughs, somewhere between breathless and obnoxious. "That was so cool." "I'm invulnerable," Rodney says. He can't stop smiling. It must look ridiculous, but he doesn't care because invulnerability is happening. And he's already trying to run the calculations in his head, simultaneously counting out all the possible ways he could use his new superpower going forward. How he feels safe for the first time since stepping through the gate 2 weeks ago. Shepard is staring at him again, a wild spark in his eye. Before Rodney can piece together what's happening, Shepard leans in, right into Rodney's space. What if I... Shepard doesn't finish the question, just tilts his head, and there's no way this is happening. There's no way Shepard's about to kiss him. It's ridiculous. It's absurd to even think it. But Shepard does. He leans in and... Shit! Shepard's head whips back and he brings a hand up to rub at his mouth. That stings. You kissed me, Rodney says, because saying it might make it real. Technically I didn't, Shepard says, still rubbing at his mouth. It startles a laugh out of Rodney, and once he's started, he can't stop. After a moment, Shepard's laughing too, leaning against Rodney's shoulder. There's a steady tingle across the shield, rather than the warmth of another body, and Rodney can't believe this is really happening. Come on, Shepard says, right into Rodney's ear. He pulls back fast, already headed out of the lab. I've got another idea.
All You Have to Do. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 4, 38 Minutes. Read by Myfic. Summary. It could have started when John's heart stopped. Or Rodney has a minor crisis. It's the first time Rodney's had to sit vigil in the infirmary. He's seen plenty of people do it at the SGC and Area 51, even in Siberia. It's never seemed important before, just some trivial ritual to waste time. He gets it now. Someone has folded Shepard's hands over his stomach. The image has Rodney frozen. With his head tipped back on the pillow and his hands folded just so, Shepard could almost be dead. He was dead just a few hours ago, and a panicky part of Rodney's brain can't let it go. Pulling out his tablet, Rodney resolves to harangue Carson along with each and every nurse who stops by until the culprit of the morbid display reveals themselves. It almost distracts him enough to ignore the fact that he can't bring himself to reach out and readjust Shepard's hands. The last time he'd touched Shepard's hands had been in the back of the jumper, back at the beginning. If he closes his eyes, he's right back there. Shepard's grasp on his hand is growing weaker by the second, and there's nothing Rodney can do to fix it. Shepard isn't a machine. He's not the kind of problem Rodney knows how to solve, no matter how much trust he packs into the way he's holding Rodney's gaze. Rodney sucks in a deep breath to banish the memory. It only takes a few minutes to hack the monitors around Shepard's bed so his tablet is hooked into the system. Shepard's life signs pop up on his screen, and he can almost relax. This way, he doesn't have to look up to know that Shepard's still alive, that his heart is still beating. This way, no one will know that Rodney isn't working, that he's spending the majority of his concentration counting Shepard's heart rate, timing his own breathing against it. No one will know it's the only thing keeping him from obsessing over the memory of armoured legs wrapped around Shepard's throat, the sound Shepard made each time they tried to remove the bug, the image of Shepard lifeless on the floor of the jumper, blood smeared and shining on his neck. Later, when Shepard's heart rate jumps, Rodney nearly drops his tablet. It takes him too long to tear his eyes away from the screen, but when he manages it, he finds Shepard awake and blinking up at the ceiling. Hey, he says, Shepard is alive, and it's suddenly the only thing that matters. Shepard rolls his head slowly to squint at him.
It worked.
Shepard breathes out, his fingers twitching on top of the blankets. Before he can think about it, Rodney reaches out and soothes Shepard's hands down with his own. They both stare down at their hands, layered together on the blanket. Shepard is tense enough that Rodney's sure he's about to pull his hand away, but Shepard just turns his hand over and threads their fingers together.
You fixed it,
Shepard says, still quiet, his eyes as wide and vulnerable as they had been back on the jumper. His grip on Rodney's hand is steady, nothing like the clammy, twitching grasp it had been back then. Of course I fixed it, Rodney snaps. He can't deal with whatever the hell it is Shepard is trying to tell him. I fixed it while you just sat there getting the most disgusting hickey I've ever seen. Shepard blinks at him.
Hickey?
I'm sure all the girls will be swooning with jealousy at the sight of your ravaged neck when they could be fawning over me, since I'm the one who saved six of the most valuable members of our little expedition. But no, I'm sure it'll be all for you.
McKay,
Shepard says, squeezing at Rodney's hand. The rest of Rodney's rant dries up on his tongue.
If you want to give me a hickey, all you have to do is ask.
You're going to let me. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 5, Suspicion, read by Stranger Clegane, a.k.a. Audio Letter. John shakes out his hands as he marches out of McKay's lab. The thought of sitting through another meeting with Bates has his blood boiling, especially now he knows the truth. It's his fault that the Wraith are trailing them, not Taylor's, and the guilt of that sets his teeth on edge. Major! That's McKay, hurrying after him up the corridor. John doesn't slow down. They've got to get to the bottom of this right now and bring Taylor and the Athosians back into the conversation. It's gone on long enough. Major! McKay's voice is more forceful this time, closer too, and John almost jumps when McKay grabs his arm and pulls him to a stop. What the hell? John snaps, yanking his arm out of McKay's grasp. McKay glowers at him, though, and pushes him back against the wall, his hand seeping heat against John's shoulder. Get it together, McKay says, twisting his fingers in the fabric of John's shirt. John pushes back against McKay's hold, almost surprised at the strength behind it. Let me go, he says, and very deliberately keeps his hands at his sides. He's not going to fight McKay. You need to calm down before you go in there, McKay says, pushing harder against John's shoulder. Glaring back at McKay, John says, he's an asshole, McKay, and now we have the evidence that we were right all along, so let the evidence do the talking. John's never heard that note of steel in McKay's voice before, and it sends a shiver down his spine. You can't just go in there and yell at him, and you sure as hell can't bust that son of a bitch. McKay, John tries. He feels flush with anger and embarrassment and 100 other things that have nothing to do with the heat coiling in his gut. No, he's right. You are emotional about this. I'm emotional about it too, so is Elizabeth. This is about Taylor, it's personal. John breathes out sharply through his nose. He wants to look away, wants to storm right into the meeting room and punch the hell out of Bates, wants McKay to push just a little bit harder because he's right. Of course he's right. We're going to go in there, McKay says, tone still hard and even, and you're going to let me and the evidence do the talking, okay? And that's it. John can't stop himself from pulling McKay in, opening his mouth for a kiss that seems just as inevitable as it does monumental, looping his arms around McKay's shoulders and hanging on. McKay's grip on John's shirt goes slack, and John has to lean heavily against the wall, afraid his legs won't support him. Oh, McKay says when John pulls back. He blinks a few times, brow furrowed in confusion, and John worries for half a second he's read everything wrong. But there's a smile at the corner of McKay's mouth. That's what it took, he asks, and John pulls him back in.
Keep On Living, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 6, Childhood's End, read by Puddle Jumper Pilot. Sitting on the bench in the back of the jumper, John stares down at his hands. He can't stop them from shaking. There's blood smeared across his left hand, and he's lost in it for a moment. He'd almost ordered Ford to fire on children. Children who were killing themselves before they knew anything, dying for no good reason. Hey, McKay's voice cuts through the silence, and John curls his hands into fists. You gonna come help with the ZPM or what? John looks up at McKay and feels oddly loose in his presence. What are we doing again? I thought you got it working. His voice even sounds halfway to normal. McKay makes a noise, something distant and distracted. You sure you're not in shock? There was a lot of blood out there. I'm fine, John says, spreading his hands for McKay to see, pleased when they remain steady. This time, McKay makes a tight, disgusted sound, and John remembers the blood. Hasn't anyone ever made you watch something on bloodborne pathogens? McKay snaps, digging in one of his vest pockets to produce a little bottle of hand sanitizer. Before John can protest, McKay drops to his knees beside them and starts to scrub at John's hands with the soap and a handkerchief from God knows where, muttering all the while about the various and dire consequences of coming into contact with other people's blood. It's comforting, and John doesn't even try to figure out why. It doesn't matter. McKay looks up at him, annoyed. John smiles back. "Does the Air Force pay you to give this lecture?" John asks. McKay rolls his eyes. "Ha ha," he mutters, his focus already back on John's hands. "They barely pay me to do my actual job." The blood is gone, wiped clean, but McKay doesn't let go of his hands. John doesn't want him to. "McKay," John says, every single thing he's wanted to say today suddenly at the tip of his tongue. McKay looks up again, almost concerned. "I'm glad I didn't die when I was 25, John says, turning his hand to catch McKay's before he can pull away. "What?" McKay says, his face twisted in confusion, but John cuts him off. "I could have. I definitely wasn't safe back then, and I knew people who..." He can't talk about it. Stutters past it instead. "I'm just glad I made it." "Well," McKay says, eyes wide and searching, "I'm glad too." John licks his lips and he can't look away from McKay. "I'm glad I got to see Atlantis," he says, tightening his hold on McKay's hand. "Glad I met you." McKay stares at him for a moment, eyebrows turning in a frown. "No," he says, and the word twists sharply in John's chest. Something in McKay's cheek twitches, and before John realizes what's happening, McKay's leaning in to place an awkward kiss to the back of his hand. "No," McKay says again, cutting off the response John's barely thought of. He pushes himself back to his feet, out of John's grasp, and starts fumbling away his soap, the dirty handkerchief abandoned on the floor. "We're not doing this here. There are much cleaner, more private places where we can talk about that." All things considered, that's fair. John slumps back, watching as McKay adjusts his vest. He tries not to think about what he'll say later, when everything has had more time to settle. He tries not to think about the feeling of McKay's lips on his skin. "Now," McKay says, holding his hand out. "Now, we're going back to the ruins to see if we can boost the range of that shield so these kids can keep on living." John doesn't hesitate. He takes McKay's hands and lets him pull him up.
Historically speaking, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 7, Poisoning the Well, read by Carson's wee baby turtles. When Rodney thinks about it, and he's been thinking about, there really aren't too many conclusions to be drawn about Shepherd's reluctance to tell the Hoffins about the Wraith. Sure, part of it is a fact that he feels guilty about it. Had told Rodney once late at night in a tent, when they had both been drunk on alien wine, that he can't sleep if he thinks about it. But that's not all of it. He's told other people before. No, Shepherd is distracted. For the past few days, maybe even longer, Shepherd's head has been in the clouds. Every time Rodney glances at him, Shepherd is completely zoned out. In meetings, over breakfast, during that particularly painful banquet the Hoffins insisted they attend, Shepherd's focus has been completely off. Even more bafflingly, once Rodney notices Shepherd's lapses of attention, he finds that Shepherd is usually staring at him. Which sucks. "What's your problem?" Rodney asks, pulling Shepherd aside when they're on their way back to the gate. Shepherd throws him an annoyed look and keeps going, forcing Rodney to speed up to keep pace. "You'll have to be more specific, McKay. You're distracted all the time and you keep staring at me, and you're going to have to tell me what I've done wrong, or at least rip the band-aid off and tell me I'm off the team if that's where you're going. But you've clearly got a problem with me, so..." "McKay," Shepherd says, stopping short to glare at Rodney. Taylor and Ford keep going, their heads tipped together in conversation. "So what's your problem?" Rodney says, holding Shepherd's gaze even as his stomach twists itself in a knot. He doesn't want Shepherd to hate him, and he oddly desperately doesn't want to be off the team either. It would be so much easier if he just didn't care. Shepherd stares at him, eyebrows narrowed, but his eyes are searching, flying over Rodney's face, his jaw tight. "There's no problem, McKay," he says eventually, but he's still tense, his entire body taut next to Rodney. Rodney bites back a laugh. "Historically speaking, anyone who's spent as much time staring at me as you have the last few days has either been trying to figure out how to get into my pants or has been looking for exactly the right moment to punch me in the face." And he cuts himself off because Shepherd isn't looking at him anymore. And from this angle, Rodney can see perfectly clearly that Shepherd's ears have gone completely red. "Oh." Shepherd clears his throat and starts walking again. Taylor and Ford are stopped some distance ahead on the busy Hoven Street, waiting. But Rodney's frozen this time, staring after Shepherd as his brain reorients itself around the new piece of data. Oh, he says to himself, then pushes himself into gear to catch up. And then louder, so Shepherd can hear. Oh, we are not done talking about this. When Shepherd glances back at him, he's smiling. Of course not. I haven't figured out the best time to punch you in the face yet.
The most obvious thing. A missing scene from season 1, episode 8, Underground. By Dead Cake. Read by Sci-Fi Dancer. Why haven't we done this before? Rodney asks, dragging his lips in half kisses on anything he can reach as Shepherd sucks a kiss into his neck. Shepherd has him pinned to the wall, his hands up under Rodney's jacket, and Rodney thinks he might shrug a response. It's hard to tell. He can barely keep his eyes open under the assault. Please, he says, twisting his fingers tightly in Shepherd's hair, which has Shepherd whining. Jesus! He should really drop it. Just go with the flow as Shepherd slides his shirt out of his pants. There's a long moment then when Rodney's brain short circuits. Shepherd finally has his hands under Rodney's shirt, and he's pressing a tie between Rodney's legs. All pressure and heat and constant motion. But Rodney can't stop himself. Please, don't take this the wrong way. But why are we doing this now? Pulling himself back just enough to get a breath, Shepherd says, like it's the most obvious thing in the universe. You can build an A-bomb. That really shouldn't be a reason at all. It probably says all sorts of fucked up things about them both, that it has Shepherd panting and Rodney shivering. But... okay. It comes out more like a sigh, but Rodney really couldn't care less what he sounds like. Okay, sure. Yeah. Yes, I can build an A-bomb. I can build 10 of them. 100! Which is apparently all Shepherd needs to hear, because he's dropping to his knees and Rodney is absolutely done thinking about it.
McKay versus the DHD. A missing scene from season 1, episode 9, Home. Read by It Started With Alex. John sits in the chair at the DHD. It's supposed to be a joke, just to get back at McKay for his attitude during the briefing. Running his fingers over the console, John puts on his best playing dumb face and leans into the routine. "You're going to do what to the DHD?" he asks, spinning the chair from side to side. That's when the whole thing backfires. McKay huffs an annoyed sound, just like he's supposed to, but instead of complaining, he grabs the back of John's chair. For a brief second, John feels the gut-turning weightlessness of the ground being pulled out from under him, but all McKay does is shove John and his chair over a foot or so. By the time John's realised what's happening, McKay's already on the floor, digging around under the console. It's not like it's difficult to move someone in a rolling chair, but the very idea that McKay's physically pushed him out of the way and gone to his knees under the console right there has John's whole body tingling. And shit. Uncomfortably aroused in front of his boss and a handful of subordinates, he's definitely not high on his list of team bonding activities. There's no way he can stand up now, not unless he wants to alert the entire control room to his inconvenient situation. All he can do is pull himself right up against the console and hold on. Elizabeth and Ford are talking, but John can't give them any of his attention. He probably should. Maybe it would give him more control over the situation to turn his mind to a different problem. Instead, all he can think to do is pester McKay to speed up the dismantling process by kicking at him under the console. McKay, however, continues to surprise him and smacks at John's leg with the back of his hand. "Stop that, Major. I'm busy."
Every hair on his body stands on end, and he's short of breath, and McKay's not helping. John's brain is completely fried, so he does the only thing he can and kicks McKay again. This time McKay shoves him, pushing him over another few inches. "What are you, 12? McKay snaps, sliding himself back enough to glare up at John. Mouth completely dry, John swallows. "Just wondering what's taking so long." "I thought you wanted this done carefully. You can't have it both ways. Either I do this fast or I do it right." Since he's apparently lost his instinct for self-preservation, John says, "So, your skills are limited to quick and rough or slow and thorough?" McKay's glare deepens, and John might just be imagining the faint flush on his cheeks, or maybe that's from whatever physical labour has gone into messing with the DHD. "With the crystals?" McKay says, his voice low enough that Shepherd has to repress a shiver. "Yes." He seems to very deliberately not say more, the silence and the heat of his gaze doing all the speaking for him. "Well," Elizabeth says, suddenly too close to John's shoulder, "don't break anything." McKay grumbles something and gets back to work. He doesn't leave it, though. Every time he has to lean too far under the console, he wraps his free hand around John's ankle like it's an anchor. The way he gets up under the cuff of John's pants, his fingers caressing the skin of John's ankle and up his leg, tell a different story. When McKay stands up, smiling and red in the face, the crystals safely in his hands, John can't look at him. He definitely isn't getting out of his chair. Calculating the time it will take to rescue McKay's ass if this goes sideways doesn't even help. Not with McKay staring down at him like that. There's no way John would survive another session of Rodney McKay versus the DHD on the planet, so he volunteers Ford to go instead. Leering at him on his way from the control room, McKay says, "I'll see you later, Major." John sits at the DHD for another few minutes and tries not to think about what will happen when McKay gets his hands on him again.
Like a Freight Train. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 10, The Storm, read by Cassiope25. 12 hours. Rodney hasn't quite wrapped his head around it yet. Well, he has. He knows exactly how far away it is from now. Exactly how long it will take to evacuate everyone if he can't come up with a plan. Exactly how long it takes to run down to his lab to grab the necessary supplies and get back up to the briefing room. Exactly how long it will take to convince Kavanagh to shut up and get his head out of his ass. But he hasn't quite worked himself up to that peaceful part of panic mode where he can tune out everything and truly focus. Instead, as he wades through the disorganized pile of materials on his workbench, he finds that he's almost shaking, barely able to keep track of the mental checklist of supplies they need. The smell of coffee hits him like a freight train, and he spins around so fast that he drops the handful of pens in his grasp to the floor. Luckily, he still has enough sense to set aside the laptop more gently. "Coffee," he says, reaching out for the mug before he even registers that it's Shepherd holding it. "Ford and I are off to see the Menarians," Shepherd says, letting go of the coffee up if he's brought it just for Rodney. Which, okay, maybe. The coffee goes down easily, despite being piping hot. "Shouldn't you take Bates? He's the one they like." Shepherd makes a face, leaning his weight on the P90 clipped to his vest. It's a move he has perfected, one that looks casual and nonchalant to the average observer, but disguises the tension in his shoulders. Rodney understands. He doesn't get along with Bates any better than Shepherd does. "Remember not to drink their booze," Rodney says, balancing his coffee mug so he can bend down for his pens. Rodney half expects Shepherd to be gone when he stands again, off to the Menarians to create the perfect plan B to the plan A Rodney hasn't thought of yet. But Shepherd lingers instead. "It'll be weird without you and Teela," he says. "Like they have all the time in the world to talk. Like the 12-hour deadline means nothing." "You'll manage," Rodney says, shoving the pens in his pocket so he doesn't lose them again. "The sooner you leave, the sooner you can get your ass back here to help with plan A." Shepherd blinks at him, the muscle in his jaw working like he's facing down a threat rather than standing awkwardly in Rodney's lap. "You're right," he says, after a moment. "Good of you to notice," Rodney says, but Shepard isn't listening. Shepard squints at him, leaning across the space between them, and kisses Rodney on the cheek. "For luck," he says, his breath warm on Rodney's skin. When he pulls back, he's smiling, soft and startlingly warm. "I'll be back before you know it." Shepard doesn't wait for a response. He ducks out of the room fast enough that Rodney barely has time to start processing what's happened. An entire 60 seconds later, a whole precious minute of time, Rodney says to the empty room, "You'd better be."
Terrible Preamble, A Missing Scene from Season 1, Episode 11, The Eye, read by Tasmi. Rodney's already bandaged his arm up tightly and on his third power bar when Shepard finds him in the back of Jumper 6. There's a mess of bloody bandages around him, and his ruined jacket is spread over his knees like a blanket, but Shepard barely even blinks. "I didn't know," he says, stepping up into the jumper, careful to avoid the mess on the floor. He drops down onto the bench next to Rodney, not too close, but close enough. Rodney shrugs. "Just another day in the Pegasus Galaxy," he says, shoving the rest of the power bar into his mouth. He doesn't look at Shepard's face, just watches where his hands are folded together in his lap, fidgeting slightly, like always. Shepard's grip on his own fingers tightens. "It's not," he says softly. "None of what happened today was normal." Which is true. It really isn't normal to be held hostage and tortured and used as leverage against your friends and forced to work for your captors. But Rodney doesn't want to think about all of that, so he says nothing. "You can't," Shepard starts, but he can't seem to get the words out. Rodney doesn't try to help him. "Heitmeyer won't be back for at least another day. If you need, I'm here." Closing his eyes, Rodney leans back on the bench. He'll have to talk to Kate. He knows that. He already sees her every other week as it is. But right now, right here with Shepard at his side, no words will come. Shepard shifts, inching slightly closer on the bench. "I caved so fast," he says, and Rodney can't stop himself from looking up at that. Shepard's eyes are closed, though, where he's leaning forward, elbows on his knees for support. "As soon as he said you were both alive, I did exactly what he wanted. I didn't even hesitate." Somewhere in the back of Rodney's mind, he can hear Kolya saying, "It would seem Mr. Shepard wants you to live." He thinks about what it was like to see Kolya raise his gun on Elizabeth, what it was like to have it on him. Thinks about Shepard out wandering the city alone, a one-man army wreaking havoc on Kolya's men, how the only lifeline Shepard had was his radio, how it made him rely on Kolya every step of the way. Slowly, carefully, Rodney says, "We didn't blame you." Shepard almost relaxes next to him, slouching back against the bench, his hands resting loosely by his sides. "I didn't blame you either. You kept giving me information and ideas and time. Rodney, you..." He stops short, flexing his fingers into fists where they're resting. "It's fine. Because Shepard's words have opened something up in Rodney, and the words are suddenly right there. We were so relieved every time we heard your voice over that fucking radio, every time you bested him. When he got Elizabeth and I alone, separated for information early on, she found him the medicine, and I..." He has to stop, gather his breath. "They weren't trying to kill me, didn't push hard enough for that. It was just a lot of blood, and it hurt. And you were out there all alone, fighting for the city, and I..." This time when he stops, Shepard fills in the silence. "You saved everyone," he says, and Rodney almost believes him. "I couldn't stop him," Rodney says. His chest is tight with panic, almost like it had been with Kolya standing right there. "You stopped him from killing Elizabeth," Shepard says. And Rodney doesn't think he's ever heard Shepard sound so gentle. It hurts almost as badly as everything else. You stopped him from killing you. You fixed the city. You did good. Rodney doesn't know what to say, doesn't believe that it's entirely true, but he doesn't know how to argue against that tone in Shepard's voice. So he doesn't. He just sits there next to Shepard, breathing through every twist of memory that sparks behind his eyes. Come on, Shepard says, pushing himself to his feet. Let's get you to bed. There's really no reason, but on top of everything else, that has Rodney laughing dryly. This is a bad time to proposition me, he says, and immediately regrets it. Shepard starts kicking Rodney's mess into a pile. He's smiling, just slightly. True, he says. How about we get some rest and see how we feel when the storm's passed? Rodney doesn't know what to say. Can't tell if Shepard is joking or not. Doesn't know if he wants him to be joking or not. Standing slowly, he stares at Shepard, trying to figure it out. He probably looks like an idiot. It really wasn't, Shepard starts. And Rodney feels his stomach sink uncomfortably. But then Shepard is right there in his face. Can I kiss you? You don't have to. You can say no. I won't. I know this isn't the time. Sure, Rodney says, cutting off Shepard's awkward stuttering. He doesn't know what he expects, but the kiss Shepard places at the corner of his mouth definitely isn't it. Although combined with the terrible preamble, maybe it makes sense. It's also no surprise that Shepard retreats so quickly that he nearly trips over his own feet, stumbling out of the jumper into the bay. That's it? Rodney calls after him, making his way more carefully out of the jumper. He's smiling, though, and he hadn't thought that would be possible tonight. The end.
Like Indiana Jones, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 12, The Defiant One, read by Wonky Elk. With McKay helping Abrams and Gaul strap into their tack vests outside, the jumper is quiet for the first time in 15 hours. John almost regrets the fact that he has to leave it, or he would regret it if the prospect of exploring an abandoned wraith ship wasn't right there at his fingertips. He feels a little bit like Indiana Jones, with a crass wraith ship as his next set of ancient ruins to explore, full of untold wonders and mysterious artifacts. He's even got his own ragtag team of liabilities, tailing him into the unknown. Sure, Gaul and Abrams will probably come in handy decoding the wraith systems, if they're still operational. And McKay's creative thinking in the field is just as useful as a team of Marines on IS-6. But they definitely don't have the experience required if the mission goes sideways. Hopefully there aren't any snakes. I'm not sure Gaul has ever fired a gun in his life, McKay says, stomping his way through the jumper towards John. His face is sour and annoyed, and all John can do is raise his eyebrow. You've barely ever fired a gun before either, he says, tipping his head at McKay. McKay scoffs quietly, crossing his arms over his chest. At least I've logged additional hours since we arrived in Pegasus. I know, John says, because he really, really knows. Watching McKay practice in the armory has turned into its own form of torture for John, having to watch his hands steady on whichever gun he's handling, and the way the muscles in his arms bunch when he lines up his shot. Not to mention the fact that he can place a kill shot on a stationary target easily these days. John's fingers twitch at the thought. McKay's face is full of disbelief now, and John shrugs. You're getting much better, he says, stepping closer to McKay to pat his arm. That makes McKay smile, the little one he gets when he's feeling pleased with himself, and John smiles helplessly in response. Leaning in close enough that his lips catch at McKay's ear, he says, if I really were Indiana Jones, this is where I'd kiss you. McKay stands stock still for a moment, and John doesn't move back, not until McKay breaks from his stupor and swings around to stare at him with wide eyes. He's pleasantly pink. First of all, he says, I would be Indiana Jones in this situation, and you. But John doesn't wait to hear him out. If he did, he really would kiss him, right there in the open jumper where the others could see. He calls out the back. Okay, kids, come back in for your weapons check. Unbelievable, McKay mutters, pushing past John to march out of the jumper. The light's not exactly right, but John's pretty sure he's still blushing.
Pretty damn cool. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 13, Hot Zone, read by Maz Pebbles Sharp. Rodney doesn't expect to find Shepard in the medical lab, But that's where he is, resting with his forehead against one of the ancient decon chambers. Shepherd, Rodney says, stopping short in the doorway. Without lifting his head, Shepherd turns slightly, enough that Rodney can see his face, cast in an eerie blue from the chamber. McKay, he says, voice thick. He swallows, his eyebrows twitching together. Had to get the hazmat suits in decon. He's dishevelled and sweaty, his hair going in all directions and his t-shirt sticking to his body in strange places, riding up so that Rodney can see the skin of his waist. Rodney licks his lips, rubs his hands on the sides of his thighs absently, wishes he could reach out and touch. You just nuked the atmosphere. He still can't believe Shepard's quick thinking, the way he took Rodney's theory and turned it into something viable and perfect and so fucking stupid. Cool, right? Shepard says, tone light. He's turned back to the decon chamber, though, his hands curling into fists against the glass. Cool. Rodney hopes he sounds as incredulous as he feels. You think that's cool? You almost killed yourself and you think it's cool? Pushing himself upright to face Rodney, Shepherd runs a hand through his hair so it's spiked at odd angles. He squares his shoulders but doesn't meet Rodney's eyes. Well, it worked, he drawls. So yeah, I think it's pretty damn cool. Heart racing, sudden and unexpected. Rodney snaps. You could have died, and I know, Shepherd says, effectively cutting off Rodney's entire train of thought. What do you mean, you know? I don't even know what I mean. How could you possibly? Shepherd cuts him off again. McKay, he says. I know. He's finally looking at Rodney, right at him. Open and vulnerable and waiting, as if he's not pulling a goddamn Han Solo out of his ass, as if he really means it. Silence hangs between them for the long moment it takes Rodney to process that, to really get what Shepard's saying, to get that Shepard's been stuck in the same mess as Rodney all day, doing every last thing he could to stop it. That Shepherd knows exactly what Rodney feels about waiting around helplessly while someone's dying. Rodney's across the room before he realizes he's decided to move. He gets in close, but hesitates to place his hand on Shepherd's chest. Shepherd doesn't look away, just nods his head once, and Rodney leans in and kisses him. He pours everything he's been feeling for the past 8 hours into it, twisting his hand into Shepherd's shirt and holding on. Moving with him, Shepherd lets Rodney in. He leans back against the decon chamber, his hands light on Rodney's waist before they latch on. Making a soft noise against Rodney's lips, he slides a few inches down the door of the decon chamber just to give Rodney more leverage, as if they'd been doing this for months already. I was going to die, Rodney says, into the stubble at Shepherd's throat. The hands at his waist shift, pull him closer. I know, Shepherd says again, tipping his head to catch Rodney for another kiss. You were going to die, Rodney says, breaking it off to drop his head against Shepherd's shoulder. After a moment, one of Shepherd's hands loosens at his waist to run tentatively up his side instead. Yeah, he says softly, his breath gusting over Rodney's ear. But we made it. And Rodney supposes that is pretty damn cool.
Filling in the gap. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 14, Sanctuary, read by Goddess 47. Get the damn weapons back online so we can get out of here, Shepard snaps from the front of the jumper. Rodney would flip him off if his hands weren't full. What do you think I'm doing back here, baking bread? You've been working for 10 minutes, Shepard complains, as if that's a long time to have to wait for repairs on a system as old and delicate as the jumper's. Taylor and Ford will be getting lost out there without us. Not even Ford could get lost checking out the perimeter of a clearing in the jungle, Rodney says, shifting another crystal into place. The crystal lights up and thrums happily, and Rodney can't help but grin at it. How about now? There's a pause long enough that Rodney worries he's fucked things up again, but then Shepard says, finally. Smiling at a job well done, Rodney starts packing away the crystal tray, shifting it gently back into position. He's caught up enough in his task that he doesn't notice Shepard at all, not until he says, almost right into Rodney's ear, 10 minutes, McKay? You sure you're feeling okay? Shepard's standing close enough to touch, a little smirk playing at the edge of his mouth. It's suddenly entirely too warm in the jumper. For a half a second, Rodney considers marching right out of the jumper and into the thick tropical air of the planet. He could ignore everything, just like they've been doing for weeks now. They'll laugh and bicker and stay just outside each other's bubbles, everything completely normal. But he can't bring himself to do it this time. McKay, Shepard says, his smirk softening into real concern at whatever he sees on Rodney's face. Rodney's heart skips a little, and he can't stop his eyes from wandering down Shepard's face to his lips, which are full and shining just a little bit in the glow of the jumper. It would be so easy to lean in and kiss him, to finally get his hands on Shepard the way he's been imagining. If only he had the courage to take the risk. Swallowing an uncomfortable smile pulling at his lips, Shepard says, We should make out until Taylor and Ford get back, Rodney says, filling in the gap. Shepard takes a very small but very obvious step backwards, his mouth falling open a little in surprise. Rodney can't even appreciate the way Shepard's blushing because he's too busy kicking himself for being so utterly tactless and stupid. Squeezing his eyes shut, Rodney tries to collect his scattered thoughts enough to repair the situation. Listen, he says, at the same time that Shepard says, Rodney. There's a silence again as they both wait for the other to continue. When Rodney looks, Shepard's still flushed, his arms up across his chest, watching out the back of the jumper. Look, Rodney says, because it's obvious Shepard's not going to start again. He forces a laugh. It was stupid. We can forget I said anything. Shepard says, eloquent as always. I'm not. You're straight, Rodney says, because Shepard's embarrassment is only feeding his own, and this needs to be over yesterday. I get it. Don't worry. It's fine. Shepard's face screws up into a glare, his eyes finally zeroing in on Rodney again. I wasn't going to say that. But it's true, Rodney says, turning around to fumble with the pockets of his tack vest so he doesn't have to see Shepard's face anymore. Let's go get the ZPM and never talk about this again. The silence behind him is expansive, heavy, and painful, and it takes everything Rodney has not to turn around to see what it looks like. He doesn't think Shepard will retaliate, even if he doesn't approve. It's not his style. The rejection hurts all the same. It feels like an hour has passed before Shepard gets out a rough fine and storms down the ramp out into the jungle. Rodney takes another moment to gather himself, taking a few measured breaths. Whatever happens next will be fine. Shepard will get over it eventually, and Rodney will have to suck it up and live with it. By the time he catches up to Shepard and the others at the edge of their clearing, he's almost convinced himself things are normal.
What It's Like to Drown, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 15, Before I Sleep, read by SquidgyPDX. John tips his head under the spray of the shower and imagines what it's like to drown, to be trapped, with the water rising, spraying in from every crack until there's no air left to breathe. It's not how he's ever imagined dying before, but he can't get the image out of his head now. He feels hollow, the thought of drowning the only thing left in the wake of old Weir's story. Except it's not just his death he's imagining, it's everyone's. Zelenka and Ford, and Carson, Sumner and Groden, and McKay. Taking a breath, John tries to clear his head, tries to make those things as small as possible, to bury them far, far under the pressure of the shower, so he doesn't have to examine them too closely. By the time he steps out of the shower, he feels more like himself than he has since old Weir looked Elizabeth in the eye and said, "I am you." It's not a surprise to find McKay standing in his room when he opens the door to the bathroom. McKay has been at his side all day, and it's only right that he's here too. "This is stupid," McKay says, crossing his arms over his chest. John grabs his sweats and t-shirt off his desk and steps back into the bathroom, leaving the door open. "You breaking into my room at 3 a.m? I agree." McKay grumbles something that John doesn't catch, but he's still there, still staring at John when John comes back. "Look," McKay says, shifts forward like he's going to take a step, but stops short. "This thing we're doing, I know I'm not imagining it." John knows exactly what McKay is talking about. There's definitely a thing where they flirt and bicker and pick at each other and stand too close and lean on each other for support. There's a thing, one that's nice and comfortable just as it is, but John's barely imagined doing anything about it. McKay waves a hand between them. "Everyone knows, so it's stupid that we're still pretending we don't." "No one has any idea, McKay," John says, crossing his arms defensively. He's been careful. He has to be careful. He knows how to be careful. Shaking his head, McKay makes a sound that's almost like a laugh. "Weir knows, both of them. I think Taylor and Zelenka too. Carson guessed it back in Antarctica. I wouldn't even put it past Ford at this point." John bites back at the denial that rises up in his chest, clenches his jaw against it. There's no point. McKay's brought it up. McKay's going to do something about it, so there's no point in denying it any longer. Now that he's thinking about it, John doesn't want to deny it at all. "They died, Shepard," McKay says, eyes plaintive. "That other us. They died, and they never let this happen. It would be so stupid if we let that happen to us, too." Around the sudden tightness in his throat, John manages to say, "What are we supposed to do about it?" McKay scoffs and says, "Of course." Before John can really react, McKay's in front of him, pulling him down for a kiss, his hand warm on the back of John's neck. John's not sure how long they go on for, not sure how they held out until now. With McKay everywhere in his own hands, holding McKay right there, he's not sure how he'll ever be able to move on from this. It's like he's drowning, except McKay's breathing life right back into him, and John knows there's no going back.
An Easier Angle. A Missing Scene from Season 1, Episode 16, The Brotherhood. Read by Cookie Mom 6067. There's nothing to do, really. Kolya's busted their radios and their guns have been confiscated again, left in a pile near the DHD and watched over by the Daganian guard. The new Brotherhood is entirely unyielding in their convictions. They are, however, willing to gather up and return the surveying equipment from Atlantis if they want to wait for it. And there's really no reason not to wait. It isn't as if there's anything to spare on Atlantis. So they're waiting. "Dr. McKay has been gone for quite some time," Taylor says. John thinks wistfully of his watch. He feels naked without it. Maybe it's in the pile of their gear. Maybe Kolya took it for a souvenir. "I'll go find him," Ford says. failing entirely to hide a wince as he stands. John waves a hand at him. "Stay here," he says, and heads out. Finding McKay turns out to be fairly easy. He's just over a nearby hill, sitting on the patchy grass with his arms over his knees, staring into the distance. He's holding tight to his arm, the one where his scar has barely healed over from the storm, from Kolya and the Janai. John takes a deep breath to ease the tightness in his chest. There's too much to say. Too much to unpack, about being held hostage, about being tortured. So John doesn't say anything about it at all. He opts for an easier angle. "Sorry about the girl," he says, even though he's not. Not really. He's sorry that McKay was hurt by her. Not that they didn't work out. When he thinks about it, the only thing he feels about that is relief. Ignoring the way his muscles protest, John drops down to sit beside McKay. He needs to round out his gym routine. Digging for the past 2 days has really fucked with some muscle groups he's clearly forgotten about. McKay laughs, but it's soft, self-deprecating. "You know, this isn't even the first time someone has used me like that. Flirted with me and flattered me, and then taken credit for whatever project we were working on. One of them even slept with me once." "Maybe I should have gone for my PhD," John says. He stretches his legs out in front of him and does not think about the look on McKay's face when the Mensa thing came up. "If I'd known there was so much sexy espionage involved, maybe I would have." "You," McKay starts, whipping his head around to face John. He's staring. "Again." John tries not to preen. How did I not know?" John shrugs. He catches a glimpse of how McKay's mouth is hanging open, red and inviting, and has to look away. Never came up. McKay shifts next to him, his hand suddenly pulling at John's shoulder so John has to look back at him. He's too close, his eyes wide and searching, and John's mouth goes dry. "This is going to sound crazy," McKay says, moving somehow closer. "Wouldn't expect anything less," John hears himself say. He can't believe how hoarse he sounds. McKay stops to lick his lips, and John is mesmerized. "You have to know how hot that is." He's so earnest, so direct, that John feels as if the ground's been pulled out from under him. Breathless, John says, "That's not why I took the test." McKay digs his thumb into John's shoulder hard enough that John adds, "But it might have had something to do with going back for my second master's." "Shut up," McKay says, pushing at John's shoulder. The shove isn't hard. There's barely any force behind it at all, but John collapses under it, easing himself back until he's lying on the ground, and McKay's leaning over him, purposeful and slow. The kiss is easy, smooth, and fluid and perfect, completely contrary to the way John's heart is racing. He's completely caught up in McKay, twisted around inside out by each little noise McKay makes, by every brush of McKay's fingers on his skin. "You're not just doing this to steal credit for my work, are you?" McKay asks, running his hand down John's chest, the steady pressure of his fingers short-circuiting every thought in John's head. "No," John starts, gathers his breath and tries again. "No promises." McKay laughs, warm and close and genuine, right there against John's mouth. "Fuck it," McKay says, and John wants to hear it again. "I don't even care."
Fallen Down on the Job, a missing scene from season 1, episode 17, Letters from Pegasus, read by A Storm of Roses. "Carson's upset that you skipped out of your post-op checkup," McKay says from the doorway. John had hoped that hiding out in his office would mean no one would find him. He should have taken into account McKay's stubbornness. Closing his laptop, John leans back in his chair. He hasn't actually gotten very much work done. He can't keep his hands still long enough to type anything. "I'll get there," he says, even though he has no intention of reporting to the infirmary. "That bad?" McKay asks, stepping into the office so the door can slide closed behind him. John spends half a second debating whether or not to tell McKay the truth, whether to sugarcoat it and smile out an optimistic line about their eventual success. He ends up saying, "I think I've reached panic." Frowning, McKay slides into the chair opposite John's desk. "That's bad," he says. "I've never seen anything like that," John says, his voice uneven. "There's nothing he can do about it, just like there wasn't anything he could do back on the planet. I don't see how we can survive that, not even with a ZPM from M7G677. For a long moment, they sit in silence. John thinks of the message that McKay and Ford are preparing, how their legacy will at least mean something to the people back on Earth, even after the Wraith have come and destroyed them like they destroyed the civilization back on Orin's world. Everyone will have one last chance to send something back to their families, back home. But that's it, really, the sum total of what's been eating at him since the briefing. Everyone is suddenly talking about their homes and their families, bolstered by the knowledge that at least something they love will be safe. John doesn't have that. All he has is right here on Atlantis, and all of it is going to be wiped out along with him in the end. "This is bullshit," McKay says finally. When John glances up at him, the shock on McKay's face is transformed into anger. "You don't get to sit in here and give up like this." John feels the words like a physical blow. Anger threads under his skin in response. "What do you want from me, McKay? We're going to lose, just like the ancients did. It's stupid to waste time thinking otherwise." McKay's glaring at him, his hands tight on the armrests of his chair. "In case you've forgotten," he says, his face starting to turn red the way it does when he's stepped beyond anger into rage, "we have a pretty good track record when we're up against certain doom. I'm still here. We're all still here. We protect each other. It's what family does." That catches John behind the ribs, chokes the air out of his lungs, and sucks the anger right out of him. McKay's not the one who's supposed to be saying that. It's his line. Somehow, when he's fallen down on the job, McKay's right there, picking up his slack for him. McKay's there, and just like Taylor, he's not going to take no for an answer. Licking his lips, entirely hollowed out on the inside, all John can manage is, "Right. It's enough." McKay nods and stands, holding out his hand across the desk for John to take. John holds McKay's gaze for a moment, swallowing down the gratitude that twists in his chest. He takes McKay's hand, lets McKay pull him to his feet. "You're such an asshole," McKay says, his grip still tight on John's hand. "I should be getting some well-deserved rest, and instead I'm here and you're just..." John doesn't get to find out what he is, because McKay cuts himself off and leans across the desk to kiss him instead. It's rough, desperate, and fierce, and John's caught so completely that he couldn't pull back if he wanted to. When McKay does back off, taking a whole step back from John's desk, letting go of him entirely, it's all John can do to say, "That was a surprise." "Please," McKay says, all whiny arrogance and pride once again. "You're too smart to pretend this was heading anywhere else."
Slow to Wake, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 18, The Gift. Read by Wandering Hawk. "You need to get some sleep," John says, sitting up from the control chair. It dims beneath him almost instantly, but it had barely been there to begin with. The chair doesn't feel like the one back in Antarctica, full of energy buzzing around in his head. This one is slow to wake, its lights dull rather than sparking with life. It doesn't even allow him to pull up a star chart, let alone gather any information on the shield's power requirements. In the end, Zelenka storms off, hands up, leaving John alone with McKay and whatever puzzling data the chair has spit out on his tablet. McKay makes a noise like he's agreeing, but he's clearly not listening, absorbed in the information in front of him. "McKay," John says, turning it over more like an order than a question. This time, McKay's head comes up to look at him, squinting at him in confusion like he'd forgotten John was there. "What, are you getting something?" John rubs a hand over his face, biting back a sigh. "You need a nap," he says, nudging at McKay with his foot. "I'm not a toddler," McKay snaps, attention back on his tablet. Standing up, John steps off the platform and grabs McKay by the arm. "We're going to see Weir, tell her what you found, and then you're going to go to bed." But McKay is staring at John's hand on his arm, clearly zoning out again. "McKay," John says, squeezing just slightly. McKay's eyes jump up to his face briefly, but then they're dropping, stopping on his lips and... Okay. It's not like John's never thought about it before. A lot. Many times. Even today. Just now. While Rodney's entire attention had been on him and the chair. If I kiss you, will you get some rest? John asks, adjusting his grip on McKay's arm. Blinking up at him, McKay says, What? So John kisses him, leans in, and presses his lips to the corner of McKay's mouth. Shifts over until McKay meets him, opens up, and McKay puts a hand on his chest, pushing him back. Are you bribing me with sex? He asks, the flush high on his cheeks, turning John's stomach into all sorts of knots. Maybe? It's all John can think to say because, yes, he kind of is, but also he'd do this in all sorts of other circumstances, too. It was just a kiss. McKay's eyebrows slant together, and he looks more offended than John's seen him in a while. Just a kiss? He asks, and the hand on John's shirt curls into a fist, twisting the fabric tight across his chest. I'll show you a kiss.
Fast forward. A missing scene from Season 1, Episode 19, The Siege, Part 1. Read by Juniper Phoenix. Jumper 1 is already lit up when Rodney arrives, but it's Shepard inside, not Miller. Rodney almost turns around to leave. Maybe Shepard's taking the team in the jumper and Rodney just hadn't gotten the memo. Before Rodney makes up his mind to leave, Shepard swivels to face him and says, I should be flying this mission. Rodney swallows, carefully sets down his supplies on one of the benches, and doesn't look up. Yes, it should be Shepard. It was supposed to be Shepard. When Rodney'd come up with the idea, it had been Shepard. Taking a deep breath and blowing it out through his teeth, Rodney says, Well, we're each going where we're needed most. That's bullshit, Shepard says, but there's no heat behind his words. He's just as resigned to this as Rodney. Anyone could scout alpha sites, but this... Rodney flips open one of his boxes, adjusts the supplies inside unnecessarily. He can't imagine looking back at Shepard. It's fine. Miller knows what he's doing. Elizabeth needs you here. Shepard stands and Rodney can feel each step he takes across the jumper in his very core, but he keeps his head down. This is worse than with Zelenka. Rodney wishes he could fast forward past it, wishes Shepard hadn't put them in this position in the first place. The jumper's ready, Shepard says, and he's only a foot away. It could be miles, an entire solar system. I checked it over myself. Thanks, Rodney manages to say. He forces himself to look up at Shepard with a tight smile. Shepard is passive, unreadable at the best of times, and now Rodney can't even begin to try to decipher what he sees. Take care of yourself out there. A muscle jumps in Shepard's jaw and his eyebrows twitch together for a moment. Shepard stops to wet his lips, and Rodney tries not to stare. Yeah, okay. You too. And that's it. Shepard is ducking his head, slipping around Rodney and out of the jumper. I plan on coming back, Rodney says, relief curling down his spine when that stops Shepard in his tracks. Turning back, Shepard tips his head. Well, good, he says. But he looks uncertain, like he has no idea what's happening here. Really, Rodney doesn't either. And you better still be around when I get back, Rodney says. He doesn't realize he's moving until he's toe-to-toe with Shepard on the ramp. I'll do my best, Shepard says, his usual annoying drawl catching at his tone. Rodney leans in, almost brushing Shepard's lips with a kiss, and says, Do better than that, and pulls back. Flushing, Rodney hopes he hasn't gone too far, but Shepard's following him, his lips parted, eyebrows creased, eyes trained on Rodney's lips. Definitely not too far, then. Rodney takes a step back. You can show me what that's all about when I get back, Rodney says, turning back to the jumper. Shepard breathes out sharply behind him, and Rodney bites down a smile.
The First Wave, a missing scene from Season 1, Episode 20, The Siege, Part 2. Read by Tipper. The silence after the first wave would be deafening in the empty East Tower, but Rodney barely notices. Since the chair came on, Rodney's been half paying attention to the power readings on his tablet, half entranced by Shepard. Sitting there with his head tipped back, eyes darting around the room, following a pattern Rodney can't begin to fathom. As soon as it's over, Shepard's eyes flutter closed. He gasps softly, and Rodney almost drops his tablet. Shit, Shepard hisses as the chair comes upright and powers off. He stumbles forward and off the platform, tripping over his feet until he's leaning against the wall, where he's promptly sick all over the floor. Rodney used to think that seeing other people get sick also made him sick. But now, in the quiet of the tower, all Rodney feels is worry. Don't tell me I killed you, Rodney says, taking a tentative step towards Shepard. Shepard's laugh turns into a groan, and he turns to face Rodney, still bracing himself against the wall. It's nothing like that in the jumper, he says, voice rough and thin. I was everywhere, with every drone, and now I'm... For a moment, Rodney thinks Shepard's going to be sick again, but he just closes his eyes and shakes his head, shifting over a safe distance before he presses his back to the wall and slides down to the floor. He keeps his head low and says, speaking into his knees, now I need a nap. That's good. He's making jokes. It's fine. They've survived the first wave. They've survived the chair. And they're good. Rodney crosses the room, levering himself down to sit next to Shepard against the wall. You sure you're not going to be sick on me? He asks, setting his tablet down carefully. Already he can feel some of the tension seeping out of him. Even the hard floor a comfort after working so long. Shepard nods, but doesn't pick his head up. Just need to rest my eyes. Do you need water? A power bar? They're back on the other side of the room with the rest of Rodney's gear, and the thought of standing again, walking across the room, it's almost unbearable. But Shepard is shaking his head, glancing up at Rodney from the corner of his eye. Later, he murmurs. We both deserve a little rest now. I'm sure Everett will disagree, Rodney says, but he feels drained to his bones, too tired to move a muscle. Shepard makes an annoyed noise at that and nudges Rodney with his knee. He'll yell at us when he yells at us. Until then, we can sleep. Sleep, Rodney repeats, letting his eyes fall closed. Sleep is good. After what could be a moment, or maybe many moments, Shepard shifts closer, resting his weight against Rodney's shoulder, his head tipping over and his hair brushing Rodney's neck. Rodney starts, tense for half a second, before he leans into it. Another moment, and Shepard shifts again, curling his fingers around Rodney's hand where it rests on the floor between them. This means something, Rodney thinks, but his mind is so frayed between nerves and exhaustion that he can't piece together what. This is important, he hears himself murmur, not exactly sure why. Shepard continues to breathe next to him, doesn't move at all beyond that soft up and down, and Rodney lets himself drift.